Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is January 27th, 2009. We're still in the first month of the new year, although just barely, and we're in the honeymoon period of the new presidency here in the United States. It seems that the entire world has their eyes upon President Obama as he faces a nation struggling through some real issues and what many of us are calling the worst economic times of our lives. President Obama made many promises during his campaign, and now we wait to see how many of them he makes good. One website, www.politifact.com, counted the promises he made at 510. I found that website very interesting, as it rated President Obama's ability to keep those promises he gave so freely during his campaign for office. He is currently being hoped for being the cure to the economic meltdown that we are currently enduring, labeled by some as the Great Recession. Now, in the Great Depression, I wasn't even born yet, nor was my mother, and yet it profoundly affected generations as they coped with the memory of it. One of my grandfathers lost his farm during the Depression, as did many other people. I grew up with a sober memory of that event immortalized in the auction poster from when it, along with his household goods, were sold. Hunger wasn't unusual then, nor were homeless people. Many children were being abandoned at orphanages or to the streets. Alcohol and drug use were rampant, and yes, that's correct, legal or not. Alcohol and drug use isn't something that started off with the flower children of the 60s. We had people struggling to pay taxes, rent, other bills. Mortgages were being defaulted on, causing people to lose homes and property. Banks were closing. Businesses closed. Small businesses were hard hit to survive. Credit was impossible to obtain. There were many suicides as people were unable to face the future or the money that they'd lost. Does that sound familiar? I could be talking about the issues of today now, couldn't I? Panic over the economy isn't far off from listening to people talk. The FDIC recently raised the amount of insurance covering individuals' deposits at banks to prevent panic over the bank closures from having a ripple effect as people jerk their funds out of banks. Businesses are laying off workers, yet, and some are just merely not filling vacancies that they normally would fill. People aren't spending money, whether they have it available or not, because of the fears of what the future is going to bring. Chains are closing less protective stores in hopes of preserving their other stores, and every day we hear about more people who have been laid off. I'm just like everyone else. I have a job to every morning. It's a small business, a standalone one, and we depend on people having disposable income for so-called luxuries, such as pets and travel. I've worked there nearly 6 years. The business is well over a decade old. Statistically, it's the sort of business that's unlikely to fail. And yet, each week, I'm wondering, will I get the bad news this week? Will I have a job next month? I have friends who've been laid off from their jobs and other friends who have seen coworkers getting laid off and having escaped that axe themselves for now. But who will be next? The Gulf Coast has a better economy than most areas, but for how long? What kinds of jobs will be available? Will I be able to find a job again if I was to lose this one? Job hunting is a traumatic, stress-filled occupation with no pay. To get paid, you have to find that elusive employment. Each time you apply, your ego is exposed to anyone that wants to take a pot shot at it, as you're suddenly forced into the position of selling yourself as the best employee for that job. In the Great Depression, despite the lack of funds for many things, one thing that remained very popular was going to the movies. In the dark theater, you could escape the mundane struggle of life as you immersed yourself in romances or adventure or someone else's struggles. Radio, books, and magazines were also popular pastimes, satisfying that urge for escapism. Now, granted, radio programs of the day were not quite like the one you're listening to tonight. But they also didn't have a computer and the internet in the 30s for entertainment. Today, we have an access to myriads of avenues for escaping our problems that weren't available yet then, from the ability to stay right at home and download a movie to view that same evening, ordering a pizza, just about anything you can possibly imagine. You can get off the internet, music, whatever. We have podcast programs on demand on almost every topic imaginable in satellite radio stations. The average home has hundreds of television stations. It's nothing like days when televisions were few and far between, black and white and filled with mysterious vacuum tubes that seemed inclined to all sorts of paranormal phenomena, besides the magical function of making a picture appear on the tiny screen in that huge console. And once upon a time, reference books were vast, heavy tomes, largely relegated to the world of libraries. Few books graced homes in comparison with the library's vast assortment. Everyone with the ability to read seemed to sooner or later visit the library. Today, we have vast amounts of information available right from our cell phones, let alone from the computer in our office or at home. E-book readers are still a bit expensive, but are becoming much more common every day. I have about a half dozen magazine subscriptions myself that are strictly electronically delivered, although they are also available in print format. I like the electronic format. I can keep those magazines forever without my Destructo Kitty attempting to shred it. I'll confess, I'm one of those weird people that will say, oh, I remember seeing a recipe for cooking parsnips with chili and wild grapes that served with rosemary roasted nutria that appeared a few years ago in Magazine X. But with a normal stack of magazines, I'd be searching for days trying to find the exact issue. That's not the case in electronic form. As for other sorts of books, I have to admit, I rather enjoy using the electronic form of the book. Tonight's author has published two novels in e-book format, and we were fortunate enough that she appeared on our program last year to talk about her first one. That first book has now also been published in a paperback, and tonight one lucky listener can win a copy of it, which Elizabeth Egan Cox will then put in the mail especially for that listener. Now, if you would like to win that copy of A Ghost of a Chance, just listen sharp. To make it fair, it's available to the first person who emails me or texts me with a question in the virtual auditorium or raises their hand in the virtual auditorium and asks a question. To email me, send it to Gia, G-I-A, at exogenynetwork.com. That's exogenynetwork.com. Now, for the podcast audience that's going to be listening to the program long after this program first airs, we have an offer for you, too. For the entire month of February, you, too, can have a chance at winning your own copy of this book. Here's how you can win it. There's just two ways to enter. You can email me at Gia at Exogeny Network. That's Gia, G-I-A, at Exogeny, E-X-O-G-E-N-Y, Network, N-E-T-W-O-R-K, .com, anytime during the month of February. Only one entry per person is allowed, and the winner will randomly be drawn from those emailing in for the chance. You can also enter for the same chance by going to exogenynetwork.com and signing up for the newsletter there during February of this year. Now, if you're worried about being spammed, rest assured, we only send out a newsletter about once a quarter, not every day or twice a week or anything like that. We also don't sell our email list, so it's not going to result in offers to enlarge various body parts for only $29.95 either. Now that we have all of that sort of stuff out of the way, all of you who are anxiously awaiting hearing from our guest this evening. Here she is. So, Elizabeth, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. And thank you very, very much for having me back, Gia. And before we get started, I have one question. It's one word with a very big question mark. Nutria? Do you want to explain to your audience what nutria is?
Yeah,
I know
nutria.
What it is because I'm a Southerner, but...
In nutria, I finally actually seen one myself. I made jokes because I've lived here almost 6 years now.
Uh-huh.
And I've been making jokes for quite a while that armadillos really are like jackalopes, and they're plastic props that are put alongside the road to amuse tourists, okay?
Uh-huh.
Nutria, we're in the same ballpark. However, I have to confess, here in Mataree at Lafreniere Park, I had an encounter with a nutrient. They're actually very beautiful creatures. And I'm told they're very, very gentle, the vegetarians. I would call them a beaver with a round tail.
Yeah. I was trying to think of another animal they remind me of that's like a beaver, and I can't even think of it right now because you'll be more likely to find it in the rivers and the lakes of the Midwest. But, yes, nutria. I think that's an excellent description of it. And many people, because, you know, you mentioned your recipe.
I was trying to think of the most strange things that you cook besides, you know, rattlesnake or rats or something really gross. So, yeah. I was being a little tongue-in-cheek, you might have to admit, you know.
Well, now, you are talking to someone who used to shake and bake rattlesnake. So, nothing like that surprises me.
Shake and bake a rattlesnake.
Shake and bake a rattlesnake, yes. When our sons were little, my husband would take them camping. For those of you out there in the audience, I live in Southern California, but I live in the mountains of Southern California, where we have bear, bighorn sheep. We have out here they're called cougars, but they're the equivalent of what would be called a panther somewhere else toward the East Coast or the Gulf Coast of America. And we have large deer, and I can never remember if they're whitetail or blacktail, but the more common name is mule deer.
Actually, mule deer are different than whitetail deer.
Then maybe these are blacktail.
Because they're actually called mule deer because of the big mule-like ears.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's their actual name.
Yeah, okay then. Well, because that's the common name that we refer to them. And when I would travel, I was in Utah one time, and I saw what I considered to be miniature deer compared
that
to
the whitetails.
Yeah, and I was just awestruck. It was, oh my gosh, the, you know, they're really
miniature
deer.
Now, did you have
deer.
The same thrill that I did? I was in Utah, and the national park I was at, had an old pioneer apricot orchard, okay?
Uh-huh.
Well, the apricots were past ripe into that fermented stage.
Oh.
And I saw white oh deer.
Yes.
And the deer were down there. They were eating these fermented fruit. They were staggering around with dull eyes. The ears are kind of hanging lopsided. Mm-hmm. Their coats are all roughed up and nasty looking. And, you know, they look like they could use a good bath and a brushing. And usual deer look very, very sleek.
Yes, they do.
So, you know, here they were, these nasty, disgusting-looking deer because they were drunk on apricots. And it sort of, it kind of went, wow, you know, even deer will do this, you know?
Oh, yes. I think all animals are drawn to it. Bears will. We have crab apples. As a wild orchid, kind of a little bit lower in elevation from where I'm at. And if the apples sit on the trees for too long, the same thing begins to happen. They ferment.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of a race as to who gets there first, the deer or the black bear.
okay.
But nutria, I can appreciate that. Anyway, I do want to thank you for having me back, and I also want to let the audience know that they can find me on Exogeny Network.
Yep,
you know?
Elizabeth has a page right there. Mm-hmm. If you click on Donna Shades, you'll go there. Also, if you want to read about Elizabeth tonight, we do have the live page up. Go to exogenynetwork.com/live, L-I-V-E, .ASPX, and that will take you straight to tonight's page.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yes. So, you know, I've read the new novel, and I have to admit, I think the second one is better than the first.
Well, I hope each consecutive one will hook more people. Book two, which is A Ghost from the Shadows, and it is book two in the Cozy Paranormal Mystery series, of which Shannon Delaney is the lead character, and I think you used this description one time before, that people who discover that they have a paranormal talent kind of discover it in stages, like peeling layers off of the onion. And that's what's happening as this series progresses, that Shannon Delaney is becoming more aware, maybe a little bit more comfortable in her own skin, so to speak. And she's, at the same time, she's exploring her, what I call an intrinsic talent, to visit the past or talk to the past, as one of the other characters, Francisco Zavala, likes to describe it. And she's kind of getting more into the Celtic nature of what is her heritage, and that also is my heritage. So it's sort of a natural vein for me to follow. One of the things that I wanted to talk about tonight, other than my books, we'll get back to my books, but you see, I'm already looking at book three, which I'm going to start on March 1st. I'm a very disciplined person, and I set a date to start and finish a book.
That was one of my questions was, is book three, has it been born yet?
Yes, I've been doing a lot of background research. Now, I don't know if you had a chance to read the author's notes. For those of you out there in the audience, although this is a mystery series and it is fiction, I include author's notes because I am known as being a California historian as well as a historian of American history, mostly of the 1800s. That was sort of my favorite era. I know a little bit about the 1700s, and of course, you know, even a little bit more of the 1900s, but the 1800s, when it comes to research, is my favorite area. And in the author's notes, I include the logistical, factual information that was used to help weave the tale. And book two, A Ghost from the Shadows, was inspired by a really old song by a group called Procol Harum. And the song is Conquistador. During the 1970s, I think it was probably the late 1970s or maybe the mid-1970s, it was, you know, top of the charts. That would have been AM charts at that time. We didn't have much in the way of FM radio.
FM was old fogey music. I remember that.
And it was, you know, it was a wonderful, almost a folk song that was put into, I'm not a music person, so I'm really struggling here to try and describe, but it was the music of the era. So it wasn't folk music like Joan Baez or Bob Dylan. It really was like your, you know, your top 10 AM chart kind of music. And that song haunted me. And that was really a great inspiration for book two, was to bring about some of the fascinating history of California's Spanish founding, because out here we were founded by the Spanish conquistadors. And in this day and age, the word conquistador now has some very positive meanings to it as well as some very negative meanings. I picked a conquistador that shows up in the story who has a very positive reference here in California history. Anyway, anyone who likes a little bit of history woven in or laced in, as I call it, into their fiction, try out the book. But yes, getting into doing research for book three. I have to sidetrack here. I hope you noticed the references to New Orleans.
Oh, the fleur-de-lis ring. I saw your note to me that was actually based on a ring you have.
It is. It is based on a ring that I have when I was in New Orleans in 2004. There's also the reference to Joan of Arc, who stands sentry over New Orleans right off of the riverfront there.
And Lafitte.
And yes, the pirate Lafitte, who, you know, we could not have won the War of 1812 without the pirate Lafitte. And the T-shirt that Shannon's friend gave her that says, well-behaved women rarely ever make history.
Yes, that was tied in with Joan of Arc, yes.
Yes, okay. So that's really kind of for you, Gia, because out of all, you know, I did a lot of radio talk tours last summer when book one came out, A Ghost of a Chance. You were the only one that I did that was in New Orleans.
So, yeah, I don't know. You know, well, New Orleans is still recovering, and in a lot of ways it's struggling, and of course the economy, you know, isn't helping any.
Oh, you know, that brings up something else here, and I will get back to the research. We've got time, but you were talking about the Great Depression, and one of the things that came out of the Great Depression, and I forget which minister, I believe that he was sort of a circuit rider, so he may have been Methodist or Baptist, but he was the one who said, tough times don't last, tough people do. And that came from the Great Depression.
You know, that's a very, very true statement. You know, tough times don't last.
No, they don't. And we've been using the word recession with a capital R here in California for at least 2 years. It is bleak here, to the point that this month, our governor has told everyone in the state of California that if you are expecting a state tax refund, we will get a state IOU instead. I kid you not.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. If you live in California and you're going to be getting something back as a state refund when you file your taxes, chances are you will get an IOU. You will not get the money. You will get an IOU. And now there's a lot of hoopla as to which banks will accept a state IOU. So who knows?
Is there earlier in the 1900s, and I know this because I found them, I have a fondness for history and a fondness for poking around. I used to live in Arizona, and there'd be, you know, wide open areas around old settlements that were long gone. Anyhow, you would sometimes find what was called a tax coin. These were locally minted. They were usually worth one-tenth of a cent. And, you know, they weren't money, real money, but they were used as money.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm wondering, are we going to see something like that coming about again? Because it came about for largely the same reasons.
I think it will be something like that, except it's going to be electronic. I file electronically. So I don't know. I guess I should ask my bank. Will California State Tax Authority just, you know, send you a little message saying I can expect it somewhere down the line, hopefully? But it is grim out here. It's very grim. There are neighborhoods of brand new homes that are literally ghost towns. Schools, countywide, statewide, citywide, are laying off like crazy. You know, it's just really, really sad. But now, getting to the research. In A Ghost from the Shadows, Book 2 in the Shannon Delaney Mystery Series, I introduced a character named Shelley McCardle. And this time, Shannon, who has a penchant for choosing freelance jobs, She's a publicity writer, and she tends to choose jobs that, for some reason or another, she finds herself staying someplace that ends up as a porthole for the paranormal. This time it's at the McCardle Bungalow, and the bungalow is on Santa Catalina Island. There's many great structures over on Santa Catalina Island that are of the bungalow architecture. And Shelley McCardle has Scottish ancestry, and that, along with, I know you and I have talked about this before, I am a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and all of my Revolutionary War patriots are out of the southern states, and I've gone back to visit many of my ancestors who are rattling around since I traveled throughout the South. I became very, very interested in what is often referred to as mountain mystery, or what I would really consider the culture of the southern Appalachia. Now, some people say Appalachia. How do you say it? I say Appalachia.
I sort of switch back and forth.
Do you? Okay.
You know, because, and it's largely because, you know, I really don't know. I've never lived there.
Uh-huh.
I've never traveled that area yet either, so I'm not sure if it's Appalachia or Appalachia.
Well, on my mother's side, in fact, and this is on the side where my Revolutionary War patriots were, they came out of southern Appalachia. They were in Virginia during the Revolutionary War, and based on time served in the militia, they were given land grants down in the Carolinas. And so in the late 1700s, at the first census of the United States in 1790, they are up in the mountains of South Carolina, specifically that's the area out of Greenville. If anyone out there is in that area, if you look to Fisher Mountain and Tubb Mountain, that's my ancestors. And so that's definitely southern Appalachia. And then, you know, as the pioneering and frontiering went westward, they went over that would be the southern Blue Ridge Mountains, the Great Smokies, into the areas of Mississippi and Tennessee. And my grandfather came out of the Cumberland area of Tennessee. And that kind of got me to thinking, because the greatest cultural ethnicity in all of America is Scots-Irish. And there's a marvelous book written by, I can't remember his first name, but his last name is Webb. That's W-E-B-B.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Born Fighting, and it's really about the Scots-Irish migration. Now, you'll notice I'm saying Scots-Irish. Many people still say Scotch-Irish, and I'm only going to correct that as far as being into genealogy. Plus, Scotch is a whiskey. And, you know,
yeah.
I happen to like whiskey, so let's call Scotch a whiskey. But I do know that many people will still say Scotch-Irish, and that's perfectly acceptable. Anyway, the Scots-Irish gene, that DNA shows up in more Americans today than any other ancestry. And I just thought that was absolutely fascinating. And so that got me thinking about what's often called Appalachia magic. And because it is predominantly Scots-Irish, and then Irish, and then Welsh, and then German, and then some Cherokee, and I'll talk about the Cherokee in a minute, most of what the magical beliefs that come out of Appalachia are directly descended from are the Celtic beliefs out of Ireland, Scotland, and the UK. And I just became so incredibly fascinated with this, because there are basically, a couple of different aspects to it. The first one is spiritual, and that's the nature-based aspect of Christianity with the Celtic spirituality of that the God is present in all of nature. It is all around us. And then the other one is that in Appalachia, it is very eclectic, meaning that it could vary from region to region. One of the aspects about the Appalachia culture is that people don't identify themselves so much with a particular clan as they do a region. I think that sort of echoes closely in southern culture and then in New England culture. Often if you meet people whose ancestors or just their relatives came out of some of the states up in New England, you know, Connecticut, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Maine, instead of saying, my ancestors are from Maine and Connecticut, they say, we're New Englanders. And the Appalachian culture does very much a similar situation there. And then the other aspect to it is that they are family and clan-based, and that harkens directly back to the Celtic roots coming out of Ireland, Scotland, and the UK. They're geographically centered in the sense that they identify with a place. They're very connected to their mountain habitat because they've carved out a living there, and they kind of, and I mean this with really great respect, they wear the dirt, they wear the greenery, they wear the water, they wear the natural elements of their habitat because they are at one with those natural elements. Another one is that they are very nature-oriented. That goes back to what I was just mentioning. And this is particularly seen in the folk lore, and I'm going to use lore here, meaning that it became a science of how they grew to live with nature. And you see that in, how they would learn to plant by the moon, or they would learn to read the weather by the signs of nature. Yet another aspect was oral and written tradition. Part of that, here's a wonderful little one, part of oral tradition, plant corn when the dogwood is in full bloom. Plant late cucumbers when the sign is in the twins. So it even harkens to what we call the zodiac today. The sign of the twins would be Gemini, and that's, most often in a particular time of spring.
Uh-huh.
They were very practical in the way that they lived. And at the same time, they were very spiritual. So in a way, you could almost say that their magic was practical magic. They believed in a unified system. In the sense that they didn't segment parts of society. They saw that humanity was part of the whole and that the world was part of a greater existence. I'm probably just totally bending your ear here.
Oh, no, that's fine.
The other aspect is that it's very interesting. Okay. The other aspect is that a seer, and I mentioned seer in A Ghost from the Shadows when Aunt Dora says that name to Shannon. Seers were commonly called granny women, and it had nothing to do with their age.
Uh-huh.
A little 12-year-old girl, if she had the gift for divining, if she had the gift for healing, if she had the gift for midwifery, she was considered a granny woman. A witch was usually a man, and men were most often water witches. What does that bring to mind?
Well, my great-grandmother was a water witch, and she found water.
Exactly.
I forget what the name of it is. Divining water, I think, is what they say it is.
Divining water, you're right. There is another name for it, and I don't have that here in my...
Yeah, it slipped my mind because my family referred to it as water witch.
Yes, yes. And that was where you would use, a Y-shaped switch from a tree.
Or a Y-shaped wire.
Or they would use some type of a metal rod. I understand that copper works especially well. But I think what is so fascinating about this is that in an area today that often is considered, that maybe the people, some people consider people out of Appalachia to not be very worldly, and yet they were extremely worldly when it came to survival and when it came to treating all people with a certain equalness that you don't find in a lot of our cultures today. Some of the characteristics that they believed in is that a division of all that exists is distinct in warring camps of good and evil, a sense that all things have their own sentient quality, be they plant, animal, or inanimate object, and that their intent for good or evil can be made manifest. And that has to do with how we as humans use those things given to us. Do we use those things for good or evil? There's a strong belief in the influence of the Christian devil. an acceptance that magic is real and that it can be worked for either good or evil, the belief that certain individuals are blessed with paranormal powers and that their magic is always more powerful than that of a layperson. There's a sense of fatalism in the face of dire circumstances, particularly during severe illness or intrusion by outsiders into the local way of life, conditions which no amount of magic can completely cure, that the resting places of the dead are places wherein evil may lurk, but which contain great magical powers which can be harnessed by the brave, an underlying magical philosophy which says it is wicked to work magic for monetary profit or to gain power over another individual, though the latter condition is frequently ignored, especially in matters of romance. I think that's so cute. The acceptance of the reality and potency of magical curses. The belief that nature provides omens and portents of the future, and these are to be heeded by the wise. And an emphasis upon actions rather than upon thought and willpower as the ultimate magical catalyst. Those are considered the 11 traits characteristic of Appalachian. Some of the other things that I think is so fascinating that I've discovered in my study is that many of the people who follow the Appalachian mountain religion still practice the ways of folk magic, especially nature lore, superstitions, and herbal healing. They believe that God gave people certain gifts to help others. They also believe that the worldwide view of Christianity as they practice it is not an opposing belief or contradiction to their use and practice of folk magic. And that, and I love this, that the knowledge of their ancestors represents a kind of wisdom rather than an ignorance. Sounds to me like they are on to something.
Yeah, and you know what a lot of people don't realize is that this ideology, you know, I guess I'd call it, was born in southern Appalachia, but it often progressed westward with people who left from that area and resettled in other areas.
Oh, definitely. You know, most of these people were the kind of people that we would say they lived by the land, you know, because the southern states were and still are greatly agricultural. And so, this is the story of my own family, who originally came out of County Cork, Ireland, in the 1700s, came here. My grandfather was born in Tennessee. He migrated to Texas, and from Texas they came out to California. And so they bring these, I guess you would call it, their family tradition.
It's sort of like a culture, you know. Mm-hmm. Granted, it's a smaller piece because it just goes with their family. Often groups would move together,
yes.
Three or four families, five families, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they'd be related, sometimes not necessarily. Or at least not in a way that's immediately, you know, noted by someone who looks at old records now. I happen to be working on my own family genealogy, and I have stared at many in 1920s census. You
yes.
know, as you try to find out where were these people, and then, you know, you get into, I'm thinking it was the 1890 census was burned, or 1900, right about there. There was a census that was burned.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's illegible usually, at least the sections I need to find, if they even exist, it's illegible. And, you know, it's been highly entertaining and frustrating as you try to figure out where were they then and who was with them.
Yes. I've taught classes on genealogy, and I've told my students, if you fall into a black hole in looking for your ancestors, go back to a couple of censuses where you last found them and look to see who their neighbors were. And so that means, you know, going pages forward and pages after in the census where you find your own family. Because, as you just mentioned, they often traveled in groups. Because when they pioneered an area, they did, you know, this was the clan effect. They depended on each other in those times of need. There was a lot of intermarriage. They would most likely all go to the same church, or they would all go to the same revival, especially in the southern states where you had what's called a circuit rider minister out there in the frontier.
Yeah, he might only show up once a year, and everybody got married and buried, and, well, they were already buried or married, but
yeah.
They had their little ritual when he showed up.
Yes, and as you just said, maybe the minister would only show up once a year, and even though people were buried when they died, a funeral service may not take place for a year until the minister showed up.
And sometimes you'll find some very strange things, like I have found, and I've been to the cemetery that was not far from where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen the tombstone. I know the last name on the tombstone. But in the census documents, instead of having the same last, and I was always told it was my great-grandfather's younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
In the census records, it is my great-grandmother's younger brother.
Oh.
Last name does not jive. And there is no record at the church that buried and married everybody of his funeral,
uh-huh.
which I find a little peculiar. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you find some real strange things.
Yeah.
And the story that I had always been told about how they came to the United States, I have found through census records, is not true.
Oh, well, Gia, I think that's quite common. I was told by someone in my family who grew up in a time where Irish was sort of frowned on, that we were Swedish. And I kept saying, no, it says right here in this history of Tennessee, and, you know, I mean, this history of Tennessee goes back to the 1800s, that they came from County Cork, Ireland, and going back into Ireland, you can find the Irish spelling of the name O'Sewell. But if you just said Sewell, and if you did it with sort of a Swedish accent, you could understand why someone could pass for that. Another aspect that I have found is that there's another kind of a hidden culture that can be very hard to do genealogy on, and I've done some genealogy on it for a friend, and that is what we would call in popular culture gypsies. And gypsies, you know, that's a term that is a very broad umbrella, because if it's a gypsy and they come from Ireland or Scotland, they're called
travelers.
If they come from England or Wales, they're called tinkers. If they actually come out of Eastern Europe, which is the American iconic image of a gypsy, they're called Roms or Romanies. And gypsies would, regardless whether they were Romanies, Irish or Scottish travelers, or English tinkers or whatever, they would often go into an area that they could blend in by living on the outskirts or the fringe of that area. So, for instance, in this case that I was doing some research on, it was some gypsies that came out from Romania in the 1900s, and they were living in the Texas area, Houston, San Antonio, in the 1930s. Because they could live on the outskirts of the Mexican community and blend in because of their skin color and their features and their hair color and everything. Even though this one particular gypsy woman turned out to be a princess out of a gypsy family in Ohio, and she was really quite wealthy, but she eloped and ran away, and there were not exactly wanted posters, but missing person posters put out all over America for her. And when she died at the Houston Hospital around 1932. She had absolutely the best care that money could buy. And her family paid to have her remains dressed in the finest clothing, even with nylon. Now, talk about the Great Depression. This is 1932, and they have her with nylons on. They paid a beautician, which is what they called a hairstylist then, to do her hair, and they paid to have her remains shipped in a refrigerated car back to Ohio. You know, and that's just one of the most fascinating stories about, and yet, the person that I was doing this research for, they were always told that either they were American Indian out of Texas or they were Mexican out of Texas. They weren't either. They were Gypsy. But at that time period, Gypsy was probably not as culturally acceptable for that area.
And, you know, the same thing has happened, you know, even within my own family, being Native American, Cherokee in particular. They began passing as white, you know, in the 1800s.
Oh, yes, yes.
And yet, you know, in the 1900s, my great-grandmother was on the rolls and claimed land when they were doing that thing in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, you know, I really haven't gone into that side of the family yet. But I know from, you know, talking to my grandmother that this did happen. And she left because she said it was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so you do. You see all sorts of strange things happening in your family tree. You know, like I know that I have a Turkish ancestor who married a Dutch woman in England and then emigrated through Galveston.
Oh, my.
You know, what language did they speak? You can't help but wonder sometimes, you know, what was going on here? You know, why?
Yeah. Where did they end up? They came to Galveston. Where did they end up?
Kilgore, Texas area.
Oh, okay. Because quite often what I've come across is people who live up in the Great Lakes area.
Uh-huh.
And they'll ask me, you know, Elizabeth, I am looking for the port that my ancestors came to, and they didn't come to Philadelphia, Boston, or New York, and they didn't come across from Canada. Where did they come in? And I'll say, well, you need to check up with Galveston and New Orleans, because what many people don't realize is that during severe weather of winter, they often came down and came in through the Gulf, and by golly, that Mississippi River, you can go up it just as well as you can come down it, you know?
Yeah,
and so
you know,
they would
go
up, and, you know, the Mississippi begins way up in the Great Lakes.
Uh-huh.
You know, so
well,
they...
in Minnesota, you know, and they can go all the way to Minnesota on it.
Yeah.
Because it was navigable, quite a ways. I mean, I've seen the Mississippi where I would hate to be taking any kind of steamboat up it, but, you know, most of it's much larger than that. Yeah, so... yeah, it's just, you know, genealogy is very, very interesting. I'm currently working on a German, my great-grandfather, coming in from Germany, and I know he went to some place in Illinois. So I've been trying to find where in Illinois was he, because I have no idea, because the story had him come and never put him in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And it had him getting married in Germany, and his wife was born in Illinois. I think that's probably where he got married.
I would think so, and I'll just hope for you that he wasn't in the Chicago area, because, you know, most of those records were destroyed during the Great Fire of Chicago in the late 1800s.
Yeah, and he would have been there probably 1870 to 1885.
Yeah, you know, so that happened in part of my husband's family. His family lived in a suburb outside of Chicago, but Chicago was the area where all of the records were kept, and they were destroyed during that fire. And you know, go to the state of Illinois.
You know, I have a friend who's working on hers, and she knows that her father changed his name in, I think it was World War II, at the beginning of World War II, and she has no idea what the original name was.
Oh.
And he also had a first wife, and she doesn't know anything about that. And she's 69 years old. There's nobody alive that remembers her father and his life prior to marrying her mother. because she's an afterthought child. Her youngest sibling is like 15 years older than her.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts, it makes it very difficult for her.
Now, when the name was changed, was it changed completely or was it just sort of Americanized?
She has no way of knowing.
Oh, that's no way of knowing.
I look at the name and, I can come up with some possible German names that it could have been from, but she has no way of knowing.
Yeah.
And so she's kind of having, she's struggling. She's going to eventually have to find somebody who has something, written down by an older person that's since passed away,
mm-hmm.
that talks about him changing his name. And
yeah.
whether that's going to happen, because her mother never, she did not know her father had a first wife until she started working on the genealogy.
Well, does she suspect that it's, we would say Bavarian, which would be German or Austrian? Does she suspect?
She has no idea. She hasn't even been able to find a record of her parents' marriage. So she's going, were they even really married? sometimes you can find some people think that all this intrigue and people having affairs and running away. I mean, she found out where her great-grandmother had ran away with a cowboy. That was the other side of the family. So she's got some interesting things coming up, that she didn't anticipate. She just thought she was going to find maybe some cousins and stuff that she... didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's had we've had a lot of laughs as we're working on this, because we'll work on it together sometimes. As we find I was looking for a relative that I knew had died in Idaho, and I knew about when, but when I put it in, it came up with this murder thing, and I thought, well, good grief. So I pull up the news report about the murder. Well, the murder wasn't him, because it was like 150 years too soon.
Oh my gosh.
The same name, but the guy was very, very dead before my grandfather had been born.
Well, let me ask you, with your friend, okay, her father was in which war?
Well, she thinks it was World War II. No, it had been World War I is when it changed his name.
Okay, but if he was
in that era.
Yeah,
he was not a soldier. He was not a soldier.
But still, if he was in the war, he was in the military, right?
No, he was not in the military. He changed his name because of the war.
Oh, okay.
And you know how informal name changes were, at the turn of the century.
Yes. Yeah, it didn't require any documentation or anything like that. You could just reinvent yourself.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And, she's found, because her family lived in St. Louis, and, she's managed to find out some things, like her mother was in an orphanage for a while. Apparently that was either when her mother ran off with a cowboy or there was a death of an infant. Something happened. Anyhow, all of the kids were put in an orphanage for a while, yet this was a well-to-do family. He was a pharmacist. So,
Very interesting.
She did find a cousin who had heard more about the story, and the story that he had been told was that after the death of the baby, the mother had sort of had a nervous breakdown, and because she was unable to cope with the children,
mm-hmm.
they were placed in the orphanage for a while.
Oh.
Which seems a little strange by most people's standards.
Well, no, I... What time period would that have been?
The 20s.
Are you okay?
Oh yeah, I'm fine.
You know, when you did your intro, you sounded kind of like you were coming down with a cold.
Well, yeah, I happen to be coming down with a cold, but you know what? We're coming up on our break right now.
Okay.
So, I'm going to send my cold packing, and folks, do stay tuned, and we'll be right back with our guest, Elizabeth Egan Cox. welcome back to the Dawn of Shays. I'm your host, Kia Scott, and tonight our guest is a paranormal novelist, Elizabeth Egan Cox, with her latest release, A Ghost from the Shadows, a book I absolutely had a ball reading, wondering at each chapter what was going to happen next. You can read more about Elizabeth at her website, www.elizabethegancox.net. That's spelled ElizabethEganCox.net, or at exogenynetwork.com under Dawn of Shades. Now, Elizabeth, we were talking about genealogy, and sort of that brings up the next question I've got. You know, from the first two books, I know that Shannon came from Chicago.
Yes.
But where did she really come from? Did you pay a visit to Chicago and she just popped into your head like one of those paranormal images that she has seen?
Well, actually, I don't have ancestry out of Chicago, but here's the story with that. My father, Michael Egan, was born in 1905 in northern Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
During the Prohibition of the 1920s, he drove the bootleg route from St. Louis, Missouri, through northern Kentucky, through Evansville, Indiana, into Chicago. What would happen is that, actually, I said that in reverse. He drove it from Chicago through Evansville, Indiana, into northern Kentucky, and then on to St. Louis, Missouri. What would happen is that bootleg whiskey would come over the Great Lakes to Chicago. Mm-hmm. My father and his dad, Jacob, would load the bootleg whiskey onto an old truck, and my dad drove it that route into St. Louis, Missouri. And all my life, my father said to me, if something ever happens that you totally cannot take care of, and you've tried to handle it in all the right ways, through all the legal channels, then you call your Chicago cousins. During that era, there was a gang of Irish mobsters called the Egan Rats. This
uh-huh.
is true stuff. Anyone who's out of Chicago or knows that history of the whole gangland thing of during the 1920s and 30s will know of the name of the Egan Rats. And I was trying to remember, they were contracted to kill a really famous gangster. I think it was John Dillinger, but I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that's who my dad was referring to. He was referring to my Chicago cousins. And he always told me, nobody messes with Mike Egan's kids. Nobody. You call your Chicago cousins. Well, I'm almost 60 years old, and I've never had to call my Chicago cousins. A couple of years ago, I do belong to the international worldwide Irish clan Mac Egan, and that's the original pronunciation of Egan. And in my author's bio for my books, it gives a spelling. And we were just talking about how names get changed. Well, the original spelling of my surname, Egan, was M-A-C, capital A-O-D, H-A-G-A-I-N. Today, it is mostly just spelled E-G-A-N. I actually have the little bit older spelling of it as E-A-G-A-N. But, you know, that's an example of an Irish name that got changed. A couple of years ago, I was at a worldwide Irish Clan MacEgan rally, and
uh-huh.
it was being hosted by my cousin in Dallas, Byron Egan. And during the course of the day, a fellow came up to me, and he said, hi. He said, did your dad ever warn you about your Chicago cousins? And I said, he sure did. And he goes, well, I'm one of them. Glad to meet you. And so I thought, I've got to do something as a tribute to Chicago. So Shannon Delaney, by the way, Shannon is named after the Irish River, River Shannon.
Uh-huh.
In Irish folklore, water and rivers and lakes are considered female powers, female spirits.
Uh-huh.
And so, and Delaney is just sort of, I have no connection to to the name Delaney, at least no connection that I know of, and my cousins still reside in a castle in Ireland. It's called Redwood Castle. But I've always liked the name. I wanted a name that was going to be, at least Irish would recognize it as Irish, but it was easy to pronounce. Uh-huh. It had what we called a lilt to it. It was fun to say. There was a bit of musicality to it. You know, Shannon Delaney. It's easy to say. So I decided to place her in Chicago because I have absolutely no connection to Chicago other than in my family's Irish, traditions and mythology. There really was an Egan Rats. And that was just sort of my tribute. All of my characters have a family tree. All of them have a family tree. The one, if I'm doing a book signing, I will often show the one that's on Alex Blackthorn. That's one of the love interests for Shannon. And he is the owner of Blackthorn Mansion in San Diego. And I will often show that one so they can kind of see how Alex's history and his ancestry goes back to Aberdeen, Scotland. But as far as where Shannon came from, well, as a young writer, she does what I used to do. She is a publicity writer, and I used to write publicity. I used to do corporate histories. That is the soft side of public relations. What that is anywhere from a one page to maybe a six page, the kind that you write for a company brochure. And it gives a history on the company so that the community at large where the company is can relate to that company. And some of my clients have been Billabong USA, the extreme sportswear company, Forever 21. People would most likely recognize that as the Fashion 21 stores in malls. They specialize in women's junior apparel. TXI Cement, which is one of the largest manufacturers of cement in the U.S., and, you know, Matsushita Avionics. I've done, I would say, every industry that you can think of. And it's sort of putting the face on that industry so that the community can relate to it and they know who their industrial or commercial neighbor is. And so Shannon's occupation or profession, I really should say, as a publicity writer is what allows her to pick freelance assignments. She came from Chicago because her house burned down. And I thought that was kind of appropriate, you know, going back to the old Chicago fire. Her house burned down. She had been writing for a magazine. And for some reason, she thought it was a really good idea to try something new. There's a lady in her life named Sister Rosario Santiago. And Sister Rosario Santiago lives in San Diego. For those of you not familiar with the names, Santiago means San Diego, and San Diego means St. James. Many, many of the cities and even some of the counties in California are named under the Hispanic tradition of the day that town was founded or the first time the Spanish colonists found that area or camped in that area. They would look on their calendar, and if that was a particular saint's birthday or a particular day that has been inscribed to a saint, and then they would name that area for that saint. And so Sister Rosario Santiago, whom I never ever named the denomination that she is a nun in San Diego, by its history, it could be Roman Catholic, it could be Spanish Catholic, it could be Anglican Catholic, it could be Episcopal, it could be any one of the Eastern Orthodox denominations of Christianity. All of those denominations have nuns. So I never actually name what denomination that she is a sister in. But she has a lot of check writing ability, and she was put in charge of turning the Blackthorn House Victorian mansion into a bed and breakfast inn because the mansion was given to the parish by Alex Blackthorn. He inherited it, and it was more house than what he needed. And so Sister Rosario needs a really good publicity writer to get going on the publicity campaign and brochure as the mansion is transformed into a bed and breakfast. She is a very old family member of Shannon's. Shannon's parents have died. They died when Shannon was in college. And Rosario was a very, very good friend of the parents. She's the same age of the parents. She gives Shannon a call, and Shannon says, it's the perfect opportunity. You know, the future is speaking to me. And so she moves to San Diego, and she has a home away from home in the Victorian mansion, the Blackthorn Bed and Breakfast. And so that's how she went from Chicago to San Diego. But as why I chose her to be from Chicago in the first place, that's just sort of a play on my own family history and family traditions. It's sort of giving a nod to my Northern Irish cousins, because, you know, all of my ancestry is out of the South.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And my Kentucky ancestors consider themselves Southern. You know, that's one of the areas where, if you're from Kentucky or maybe Missouri, it depends on how your ancestors considered themselves. Were they Southern or were they Northern? Well, my James Egan, who came from Ireland in the 1840s, married a woman named Elizabeth Corley. That's where my Elizabeth, my name, comes from. And Elizabeth Corley's ancestry goes all the way back to Virginia, of St. Peter's Parish, where I've been to that church. It's in the Tidewater area. The Corleys helped to build it in 1701. So consequently, my branch of the Egans are Southerners. But that was giving a nod to my Northern Egan cousins out of Chicago.
Okay.
You know, and it's,
well,
an area, it's an area I would like to visit sometime. I've always have had a fascination with Chicago because so much has gone on there over the years.
Yeah, Chicago is one of those cities that's just filled with history, like New Orleans.
Yes.
Speaking of New Orleans.
Yes.
You know, Shannon has been in California through the first two books. I know you have ties to New Orleans. There's mention
yes.
of her having ties to New Orleans and the interest, perhaps. Today,
there,
is she going to visit New Orleans?
There certainly could be that opportunity. I would like to see Shannon maybe on a Mississippi boat. You know, maybe
well, you know, I can see her going up a bayou to see, for
sure.
some reason, having to meet one of these mystical, magical swamp witches that every newcomer hears about.
Yes, maybe getting into a little bit of the Cajun or Creole ancestry on that.
Even one of these, you know, mansions that, you know, you hear about. I've never seen any of them. They're hidden away, you know, up the bayou, and there really is no roadway there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and perhaps, you know, it's prone to flooding in this modern age with higher tides than, you know, used to be. And more, you know, we had the, there was that huge flood of the Atchafalaya Basin. I'm not sure when, but fairly recently, in the last 50 years anyhow.
Oh, okay. I think that happened in the 1940s. Is
well,
that the one
you know,
that there's a folk song about it?
I think there was another one more recently, because I've heard my boss talk about it, and the bears came swimming across the Mississippi to the East Bank
mm-hmm.
because of the flooding in the Atchafalaya.
Uh-huh.
So she's only 69 years old.
Uh-huh.
And she's only lived here since, I think, the 50s.
I see. Okay.
Oh, yeah. You know, I can see, you know, that there must have been a more recent one. It may not have been as devastating as that first one back in the 20s or 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still sufficient to send bears swimming across the Mississippi.
That's really something. My gosh. You know, speaking of that area, I spent Halloween in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
Not the part of Mississippi where my ancestry is. My ancestry in Mississippi is up by Tupelo in Elvis country.
Uh-huh.
But I fell in love with Vicksburg. Well, I fell in love with almost every town we go vacation in. because we go into southern towns, and I've got ancestry everywhere. So I sort of, you know, when I was in New Orleans, we stayed at the Britannia Park Hotel in the Garden District, just right off of the St. Charles. Took the streetcars everywhere. Heavens, you never call them a trolley. Call them a streetcar if you're in Miller.
Right.
And, you know, I fell in love with that area. We go to Vicksburg. I fell in love with Vicksburg, and we took a haunted ghost tour on Halloween night in Natchez, something I could recommend to everyone to do.
Natchez is just a beautiful city if you want to see antebellum houses.
Yes, and this particular ghost tour that we took, it's in one of those little itty-bitty buses that have the great big windows, and but we do get out. You know, you get out on the ghost tour, and you go to the cemetery where the Turning Angel is, and you go into this old bank, and the gentleman who runs it, gosh, his first name is Eric. I want to say that his last name is Wilson, but I don't remember, but I think it's the only haunted ghost tour in Natchez. I highly recommend it. It's the real deal. And you can do that same kind of thing in New Orleans.
On the carriage tours, and I have to admit, okay, even though I live here, I love going and doing the tourist thing.
Yes.
You know, it's so much fun. And, you know, you go down there, you take a carriage ride, you get the spiel. You go do, you know, tour the various museums. You do whatever it is that you want to do. Being a tourist at home is a whole lot of fun. And I know from living in various interesting areas, often we tend to overlook what's in our own backyard.
Yes. One of the most magical experiences I ever had when I was in New Orleans was going to Mardi Gras World.
Ah, yes. Did you take the ferry across the Mississippi from the end of Canal Street?
Yes. Yeah, and yes. It drops you off there in Algiers. You can take the shuttle to Mardi Gras World, or you can do what my husband and I did. We walked through the neighborhoods and went to Mardi Gras World that way. And there is a, right before you get to Mardi Gras World, there is a voodoo hut, or I don't want to call it a store. And it's not really a hut, that, but there is a, oh, I think it was called Seven Sisters. Something Sisters. It's either Three Sisters or Seven Sisters. And I liked that one much more than the one that's on Bourbon Street, which I won't name because the one on Bourbon Street is famous.
Yeah, and it's, I personally didn't find it. Now, I was told there is another one. I haven't been to visit it yet.
Okay.
And I have never interviewed a voodoo person because even though they've agreed to them, they seem to vanish after agreeing. Yeah, you know, it's been rather difficult. But, yeah, I'm looking for certain. I'm looking for a treater. I'm looking for a numerologist. I'm looking for someone who practices voodoo. You know, and because, you know, there's certain things that it's like, oh, hey, you know, I haven't interviewed anybody that does this. And yet it translates well to an audio format. I mean, palm reading, you know, that's kind of tough. They got to be really good at talking to do that, you know, on the air.
Well, let me ask you, since you're there, does Seven Sisters still exist? Do you know?
I don't know. I will have to go looking.
Yeah, because when I was there before Katrina, and so I don't know, but
I don't know how much damage Algiers itself took. I know around Algiers it got battered pretty tough on the west bank, but I don't. You know, I haven't been over there. To be honest, you know what? I don't think I've been across the river other than to the big Louisiana SPCA facility. I don't think I've been across the river for anything else.
Oh my gosh! When we were there, we would go down and catch the ferry there, like you said, at the end of Canal Street. People need to know, they're talking about going to New Orleans, but that ferry is free. And I
think it's free.
It is one of the best kept secrets that if you talk to residents, you find out about.
If you go to the end of Canal Street on the river, you can get on the ferry, and on foot, it's free.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking the shuttle to Mardi Gras World is also free.
Yes, it is. And I forget how much it costs to go into Mardi Gras World. It's not much. But once you're there, you can spend the entire day there if you want. You take a little tour. You can try on costumes. I love doing that. And afterward, they let you go back and go through the various dens where, you know, the many of the floats are.
Uh-huh.
You can talk to the artist, as long as, I guess, you're not really interrupting something that they're doing that's very important. We spent an entire day at Mardi Gras World, and I recommend it to everyone who goes. Go to Mardi Gras World, because you kind of get an insider feel. And also, while we were at Mardi Gras World, we ate, I guess you would call it the Mardi Gras cake.
King cake.
King cake, thank you.
King cake, I had to think. What is it called? Yeah,
yeah,
king
what
cake.
Is it called?
And you can buy them in various fillings. They have a baby in them, and whoever gets the baby has to buy the next cake.
And I kid you not, and we tried king cake everywhere when we were there. The king cake we had at Mardi Gras World was the best.
Well,
anyway.
I'm told that the best one, I've had a number of king cakes, but supposedly, and I've eaten it, it's okay, you know. I keep thinking I'm happen to be a good baker, and it reminds me of what we called Swedish tea rings when I was baking them, but without the luridly colored frosting, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a ring-shaped cake, and it can have filling or it can be plain. I think originally they were plain, or maybe had fruit in them. There's a baby pushed in it. They're colored in the Mardi Gras colors of gold, green, and purple. And it's a yeast cake, and whoever gets the baby has to buy the next king cake. But Tasties, which is a donut shop, is supposed to have the best king cakes. And I bought them from there, as well as many other places, because I have a tendency to find the baby.
Yeah, well, I don't think we had the piece that had the baby. I would have remembered that. I would have brought it home.
Well, you know, and too, if you really want to have a king cake, you can have them mail ordered. A number of the bakery shops will email you. Will mail you a king cake, ship it to you.
Wow.
And so, yeah, if you search on, you know, New Orleans king cake.
Yeah.
Because offhand right now, I can see the sign that I saw just yesterday, but I cannot remember the name of the bakery.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to, you know, I'll have to check into that, because it would be kind of fun. I buy of what I would just call sort of I call it a Danish, and it's not Danish, but it's a coffee cake, and it's made from a local bakery down the hill. Down the hill means off the mountain.
Uh-huh.
And I buy it because it reminds me of king cake.
It
just kind of has that, like you said, it's a yeast cake, more like a coffee cake bread kind of thing, and it's just delicious, absolutely delicious.
You
I'd like
get
it better.
With cinnamon filling, fruit fillings, with cheese filling.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to like either the cheese or the cinnamon myself, but you know,
yeah.
That's me.
I think the one we had some kind of a fruit. I want to say pineapple, but I'm not quite sure.
Pineapple, apple, blueberry, cherry, vanilla cream, lemon cream,
mm-hmm.
coconut cream, and cheese and cinnamon are the ones that I've seen this year, and plain, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
that's just this year.
And you know what? You and I, we never, ever stay on topic.
Yeah, I know. You know, and I was asking about, you know, Shannon, because Shannon's really kind of the focal point of this book series.
Yes.
Do you ever see her, you know, getting to go to some exotic location or one with great mystique out of the United States?
I don't know if she'll ever go out of the United States, because actually I think there's enough to keep her here in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, we just talked about New Orleans, you know,
uh-huh.
Natchez, Vicksburg, Charleston. There are so many areas here in the United States.
St. Petersburg, Florida.
Oh, yes. Okay. Actually, I know St. Pete, Tampa well, because I used to vacation there.
Uh-huh.
And I have, maybe she could go to Boca Raton. I have a cousin, hello, Doug, if you're listening. He's in that area.
Uh-huh.
There are so many exciting areas that have a rich tapestry of history to it that, you know, one of the reasons that when I proposed the series, that it took place, at least the books that I'm working on right now are in California, is because I wanted something that would show a true appreciation for the founding Hispanic culture of California, which I refer to as California Hispanic. It is not Spanish. It is not Mexican. It is the blended cultural attributes of that. It was it's from the colonization of the Spanish coming into Mexico, coming up the California coast, which was Mexico at that time, and bringing with them the Spanish traditions, the Spanish laws, and then the intermarriage with the Mexican culture. That kind of comes across in book two, because as we both know, there's a conquistador in there. And the conquistador has a little dog, which is a Chihuahua. And I chose the Deer Lake style of Chihuahua after talking with people in a National Chihuahua Association, because they believed that it would have been authentic to the time that the conquistadors came into Mexico and they met the Aztec king Montezuma. I wanted there to be this tapestry of a multicultural format that is true to the origin of where Shannon is. And so keeping that in mind, yes, she could very well be in New Orleans, because that would provide such a rich cultural texture. And, you know, she could be other places. In Florida, we would get into...
In New Orleans, we've got the Irish, the Italians, the...
Yes.
French, the Spanish, the Native American, the American. I mean, just the stories of why there's the Garden District and why is there the French Quarter.
Yes, yes. And
why is there an Irish Channel?
Yes. Hey, and you know, when I was there, they were kind of starting to renovate the Irish Channel. Did that get interrupted?
Well, almost everything's been interrupted. But, you know,
yeah.
In various areas seem to... You know, and it's true of any city. You know, they go through a decline and then they go through a renovation.
Uh-huh.
And that seems to be the thing here, too. You know, we have Bucktown. Why is Bucktown called Bucktown? You know, when you get into these neighborhoods, and why do they have the names they do?
Yes.
What do
yeah.
they mean? You know, what was Pontchartrain Beach? You know, why was it? You know, and what did, like, Pontchartrain mean? What does the Wrigley's Pass mean? You know, Fort Pike, what was it like? You know, we have an immense amount of history.
Mm-hmm.
The Creole culture, what is it, you know, here versus the Jamaican Creole culture? The languages, there's a lot. There is a lot. And, you know, that's probably true of any old city, especially old port cities.
Oh, yeah, and I like port cities. I like cities that became a center of commerce one way or another. So here in California, we have the port city, San Diego. Santa Catalina, Avalon is a port bay city, used more for recreation, but still there was a lot of trade that went on there. And then inland, you have the cities that were hubs of transportation for the overland trade, such as your old stagecoach cities, or then you have your mining cities. But certainly, there is something about port cities that truly attracts my attention, and I think part of it is that I love rivers.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've always just been absolutely fascinated by rivers. I love going into Virginia and being around the James River. My ancestors lived in that area. Just came back from Vicksburg, of course, which is a huge port city, just as important today as it was in the 1800s. Maybe not as critical as it was during the war between states, but, you know,
a lot of people don't realize that
during...
New Orleans was not born because we had Bourbon Street. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that there's way more to New Orleans and why it's here than Bourbon Street. You know, that it was a port city. It was the entry into the Mississippi River and all that transport, because it's really the last chunk of solid land. There's not much land on the rest of the way to the Gulf.
No, there isn't. And I think a lot of people don't realize, unless they've been there, how deep the Mississippi is in that area of New Orleans.
Or how big those ships are.
Yes. You know, when we were there, other than taking the free ferry back and forth and just enjoying the ride going across the Mississippi, we did take one of the tours, and instead of going up to the plantations, I wanted to go down a ways and see the sugar factories and the industry, and oh my gosh, the huge industrial ships that come up the Mississippi. That is a real eye-opener, because it tells you that the Mississippi is still very, very critical to our industries here in the U.S., and that New Orleans is the first real stopping off point. You know, because it, as you said, it's the first real solid land as far as, you know, for commerce and trade and everything else. But I don't, you know, right now, I have to be really honest, I sold this series based on the fact that it was based in California.
Ah.
Darn it, Gia, no one else has ever really tried to pinpoint me on that except you.
Oh, well, you know, what can I say? But, okay, going off on another tangent with Shannon, you know, she's got two suitors in both books, Zach
yes.
and Alex. Is she
yes.
going to get a third?
Well, I'm kind of deciding about if she might meet someone in the next place that she's going to be going to, because she'll be away from San Diego quite a distance. And Alex, whom, if you've read book one and book two, you'll know he teaches at a university in San Diego, so he may not be able to, you know, just conveniently show up when Shannon kind of needs a shoulder to cry on or
mm-hmm.
a hand to hold or someone to just give a peace of mind to, meaning Shannon giving Alex her peace of mind.
Yeah. Well, okay, not to give away the end of the book, but
uh-huh.
one of the suitors, you know, is in a world of hurt, you might say, at the end
yes.
of book two. Are you going to finish the story? Or are you going to skip over that and leave us wondering what happened?
No. I will say that by the end of book three, there will be a definite outcome as to what's happening with Zach, because we're talking about Zach.
Yep.
And I have actually asked people who have read this, okay, if I had to kill off someone, who would it be? But there will definitely be an answer to Zach. And I think what's going to happen with Alex is something that Alex nor Shannon could ever, ever have predicted. But book two, there was a really good clue when Shannon and Alex went up to the sort of the mesa top of the hill that's there by the McCardo bungalow.
Uh-huh.
And there's a particular incident that takes place regarding fireflies or lightning bugs, whatever you want to call them.
I was going to ask you about that. You know, did you just dream that up, or does that come from a bit of, you might say, historical belief or historical superstition?
It comes, taking into consideration that all of my ancestry is Celtic, I would say that it did come from Celtic beliefs, but it came to me in a dream. I write most of this out of my dreams. That's why I tell people, I am never one of those people who has writer's block. If anything, I have a sense of urgency, so that when I'm actively writing, I write 2 to 3 chapters a week. Typically, I write Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I review on Friday. I edit and revise and do research on Monday.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And a lot of
that
it
kind of brought me to another question, because I was curious, what, you know, where did the stories come from? And I was going to ask you, did you have a bit of the paranormal about you, and did it seem to come from elsewhere?
I think it does come from elsewhere, and I'll be really honest with this, especially since we're going to be coming to a close here pretty soon, and so you won't be able to needle me much about it. A sister who is now deceased, her name was Mary Bridget Martinez, and that certainly gives you a really good indication about the culture in California. Mary Bridget Egan, who married a gentleman with the last name of Martinez.
Uh-huh.
And she asked me one time, she said, "Why are you so driven to write?" She said, "You are the most disciplined person I know." And I said, "Mary Bridget, I write to quiet the voices of our ancestors. That's why I write."
Uh-huh.
And so I think a lot of this comes out of listening to my ancestors. And I guess that would sound paranormal. You know what? If you were listening to me from an old family up in Appalachia right now, that would make perfect sense, because they know that our ancestors and what's passed on to us, genetically what's passed on to us, as well as the memory that is in our spirit, the memory that is in our soul, and I call that living close to the bone, so to speak,
uh-huh.
is very much as real to us as me sitting down and tip-tapping on the keyboard and looking on the screen. One of the aspects, and one of my very favorite characters who appears in the first book, book one, A Ghost of a Chance, is Francisco Zavala. And Francisco Zavala quite literally invented himself in the moment that I wrote him. And that takes place after a performance where Alex has done a magician. Alex is a magician too, as well as his ancestor, Eric
uh-huh.
Blackthorn. Alex did a benefit fundraiser performance, and he's doing a meet and greet, or greet and meet, I'm never sure which it is, in the foyer, or the common place afterwards in the theater. And everyone has left the building except Alex and Shannon. She accompanied him to this. And I was quite literally with those two standing in this empty foyer, and I thought, oh my gosh. And I just started writing, and that's how Francisco came into the story. I think I probably knew someone kind of like Francisco. To this day, I will meet people, and I'll say, oh my gosh, he could be Francisco.
Uh-huh.
You know? But to this day, I also meet people, and I say, oh, he could be Alex, or he could be Shannon, or, you know, he could be Zach, kind of thing. And, oh my gosh, that lady is Sister Rosario to the T. But a lot of it comes to me in a dream. By the end of the day, if it's been a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, when I'm actively writing, and I'm just completely emotionally exhausted, frazzled even, because
uh-huh.
writing is a very emotional experience, I will go to sleep at night and think, okay, where is this going to go tomorrow? I don't do a lot, I don't plot the whole thing ahead of time. I often come up with the beginning and a particular end. Yesterday, just out of the blue, it's like, oh, I know how I'm going to begin book three, and I know how I'm going to bring closure to the situation with Zach. I know
uh-huh.
exactly how that's going to happen at the very end.
Uh-huh.
In book two, the incident where Shannon sees her conquistador for the very last time, I wrote that before I ever wrote the first word for the first chapter in the book. And so some things just sort of come to me in a dream, and it's like I take my dreams and I incorporate factual information and history that's, you know, very much with the time of what I'm the time factor that the mystery takes place in, because this is a cozy mystery. Often it involves something that happened over 100 years ago. Although book two had a mystery that was fairly recent and a mystery that happened almost 200 years ago in it. And I just sort of kind of laced them in with things that come to me in dreams.
Uh-huh.
So is that paranormal, or is that my, what I explain as Shannon's ability as being, and you can put this in italics or quotation marks, intuitive sense And by intuitive sense, I mean that we do have more than just the five senses looking for us. I think we have a survival sense that some people would call a sixth sense. And I think we do have the ability to either, I think we can listen to the past. Shannon has the ability to listen to the past as well as talk to the past. And I think we all have that ability if we listen to it maybe from a more spiritual point of view than a physical point of view. So, I don't know, did I answer your question?
You did. You know, you answered my question with many more questions, which is, you know, really kind of a good tactic. It leaves us a little bit wondering as to whether or not your inspiration is otherworldly or not. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I think if my inspiration is otherworldly, it would be the world that is behind me. It would be my ancestors.
Well, there is that old saying, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. So.
Yes, yes. You know, and it could be that my ancestors are speaking to me and helping me live out a creativity that collectively is kind of coming together and is being channeled, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if that's paranormal or not. I know that we're running out of time here really quick, but one thing I've always said is that I don't necessarily believe that a place, whether it's ground or a physical structure, is haunted. And I'm not using the word haunted in a really negative way. I think people are haunted, whether they are people who are living today, like you and I, or people who once lived, and they need to get through to someone who is living today.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think necessarily that a ghost is someone who is not at rest. You know, I write about my ghosts as people. Alex Blackthorne, who is a ghost, and he's kind of coming more and more into his own, and that was shown in book two. Alex is a very real person who lived in the 1800s, and now he can have what I would say a purpose to his spectral life, you know, in his dealings with Shannon. He now really has a purpose. And so to me, Alex is every bit as real as Shannon is and all of the other characters who are not a ghost.
Yeah, you know, it's fun, you know, to sort of take this and play with it because, you know, it kind of gives you an opportunity to play with the ideas in a, you know, say, you know, for the reader, a safe, non-threatening way because the books aren't scary.
No. Oh, Gia, thank you so much for bringing that up. This is a ghost story. It does deal with what is termed today as the paranormal, but it is not scary. I believe that spirits can be very positive. And just like today, if you are protective towards someone, that is a very positive energy. It's a very positive influence. Well, I think spirits can be a very positive influence and a very positive energy in our lives. And by spirits, I guess I'm talking about your classic ghost. And one of the things, and this is a promise I made to myself.
Okay, make it real quick because we're almost
okay,
in time.
This series will never go dark. It will never go evil. I promise you that even though there are elements of evil, like murders and so on and so forth, it's not grisly. It is G-rated in a true cozy sense. You can leave the book open. You don't have to be afraid about who's going to pick it up and read it. It is a mystery. It is plot-driven and character-driven.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So, folks, I hope you've all had as good a time with Elizabeth tonight as I have. And she's left me wondering if someday I might get a chance to encounter Shannon Delaney somewhere here on the Gulf Coast. I hope that you've all enjoyed it, and if you're listening to this on a podcast, you too have an opportunity to win a copy of the first book in the Shannon Delaney series, straight from the author's hands. Yes. Tune in again next week as we continue our odyssey through the land of paranormal phenomena, looking for illumination along a path filled with pitfalls and strange phenomena. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.